yet another awesome interview. C.J. Werlemann. Now, what is he? Well, here's two fun facts. First, renowned atheist. I'm going to read the book's titles for you real quick because I love them. Jesus lied. He was only human, debunking the New Testament. Gotcha, Jesus. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. God hates you. Hate him back. Making sense of the Bible. Also fun. Crucifying America, the unholy alliance between the Christian right and Wall Street. That's so true. And then his latest one is, atheists can't be Republicans if facts and evidence matter. Right here. Boom. Okay. But I mentioned a second fact. He is apparently, not that he's a contributor to Salon and Alternet, which he is. Okay, that's fun. But not nearly as much fun as that he has been ranked on Twitter as top 50 most influential Australians. Okay, so one of the top 50 most influential Australians on Twitter is right here at Rebel headquarters.
I think there's a total of 55, so I'm flying.
Okay, I like that, I don't know. All right, so let's talk about your godless ways.
Okay.
All right, have you always been a communist? No. Have you always been godless, or were you born in a religion?
Yeah, no, I was always godless. I've never believed in a deity. Being an atheist for me is as natural as breathing. You know, it was never a part of my life. My mum, if I would try and put a label on my mum's spirituality journey, she was a hippie of the 60s, and somewhere along that journey, she loves, you know, Native American philosophy. She loves Buddhism philosophy, that sort of thing. And, you know, she believes in karmic forces. My dad wants to believe there's a deity, and probably chooses to believe it if you pressed him hard enough. But yeah, I went to actually a Christian school, a non-denominational Christian school, which is a private school. Never believed it, never made any sense to me, and I don't feel like I've missed anything in my life.
So that's interesting. I have a similar story. My mom is spiritual. Uh-huh. She's Muslim, but the part she likes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And right. And my dad wanted to believe, but until he read the books. And then he was like, oh my God, does anybody know what's in these things?
Yeah, yeah.
And which is kind of an experience we all have at some point if we're atheist or agnostic. And that's what happened to me. I took an introduction to Islam class, and I had this Irish professor who sold the Quran to me.
Yep.
It was weird. It was like, he's like, oh, top of the morning to you, this Quran is wonderful, right?
Really?
And he's got a pot of gold at the end of the Quran. And I was like, really? And so he gave us all the good parts. Yep. And then on my spare time, I started reading the other parts, and I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. It's kind of messed up, right? And then just like my dad, I actually went through it before him. I started reading the Bible. I'm like, the Quran, okay. But the Bible, the Bible's got to be good, right? Because I grew up in America.
Well, I think isn't that the number one force for atheism is actually reading the Bible cover to cover? And that's, my first book, God Hates You, Hate Him Back. And I actually went through this stage in my life where a number of my close friends in Australia, very close friends, all went down the path periodically for about the course of 2 years and got right into this fundamentalist, happy clapper movement, the live music, the pretty girls, and put 10% of your salary into the basket. And I'm going, what the hell is happening? Am I allowed to swear
on this? Yeah,
you okay.
Goddamn right.
Sometimes I have to control my lip. But they went down this path, and that kind of made me want to explore it. But the things I was saying about their religious belief, I knew even from a very superficial, very preliminary understanding of the Bible, that what they were saying is inconsistent with the Bible, that God is a merciful God, God loves everybody, and God is peace, and all this sort of thing. And again, that's not how I remember the Bible being taught, at this yuppie private school that I went to. And so I started getting, immensely involved into the religious text. I then experienced a suicide bomb attack by Jamaah Islamiyah in Indonesia, which is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. And that was in 2005. And that really, coupled with my friend's transformation into happy clapper Jesus fundamentalist, and coupled with the fact of experiencing a suicide bomb by Jamaah Islamiyah, I really wanted to explore what was in these religious texts. And once you start reading the Bible cover to cover, you realize that God is probably the most heinous character to ever been devised in human fiction.
So I want to get into that in a second, but I can't let it go that you just offhandedly mentioned happy clappers. Uh-huh. Okay, I don't know who those people are. It sounds like uniquely Australian. Like there's, like I could just picture in Australia, like happy clappers. Woo-hoo-hoo. Okay, this is a lot of people smoke dope in Australia, don't they?
Oh well, all kinds of drugs. You know, I think we're one of the highest drug using countries in the world.
Okay, so are those two things related? The happy clappers and
well, mushrooms is maybe, but okay. But the happy clapper Christian is really that evangelical, you know, hands in the sky, with your eyes closed, looking to some sort of, you know, shining light above. While Joel Osteen is fleecing you of, you know, $500 of your monthly salary every month.
So then let's talk about why God hates you, right? Okay. I mean, that's one of the titles that you just mentioned there. And I haven't read the Bible cover to cover. I've read a lot of it, but I haven't read it cover to cover. And I know that there are parts where Jesus is kind, and he certainly cares about the poor and the needy. Yep. And so the Joel Osteens of the world are wrong. You know, it's... You know, and he's not a particularly loathsome guy. There's loathsome guys. Austin's just like, hey, he wants to ride in a Cadillac and have a good time, right?
Yeah, he's got a lovely smile.
Yeah, he does. And and it's the exact opposite of what Jesus would do, but that's okay, right? But on the other hand, God is vengeful and angry. So which one is it?
Well, I mean, the God of the Old Testament, I mean, you know, he's a heinous character, endorses genocide. If you rape a woman, you know, if you have sex with a donkey, you're put to death. But if you rape a woman, you just pay her dad 50 shekels. So, I mean, this is
that's literal.
That's literal. That's in Deuteronomy. So, I mean, and all through Joshua, you know, the genocides of wiping out people that occupied what's supposed to be the promised land for the Israelites. You know, these are there's no moral justification for these acts. But then Jesus comes along. And Jesus was a Marxist before Marxism had a name. And look, I wouldn't have a problem with American Christendom if American Christendom, particularly the Christian right, actually followed through or endorsed the social gospel that Jesus pushed forward, looking after the needy, providing health care for, you know, the those in need. You know, if you read the Beatitudes, I mean, that reads as, you know, the doctrine of Marxism. But in America, that Christian theology has been turned into a Joel Osteen prosperity theology. So if you're rich, it means God has anointed you. If you're poor, it means you're a sinner and you don't deserve any attention. And that's why the Christian right is bound to endorse free market capitalism in this country and Jesus in this country, rather than being the liberal Marxist Jew that he was, who hung out with a prostitute and turned wine into water into booze, is a union-busting, self-deporting, you know, hardcore conservative.
My favorite stereotype nonsense of all history is when Christians would kill the Jews because they say, because you killed Jesus. But Jesus was a Jew.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's insanity. How could they have not? I don't understand. You killed the Jew.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why we're really mad at you. Like, it makes no sense, but none of this makes sense. So, like, so then let's establish the things that are clear and then get to the things that are unclear.
Okay.
So, Old Testament, yes, full of barbarism. And if the God of the Old Testament is so vicious that he would make any dictator look like chump change, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember one particular story. I don't remember which book it's from, but he says, oh, tell the people of that area, again, all in the Holy Land, that they can have your daughters, okay, because apparently your daughters, the Israelite daughters, are hot, which is actually true again today, if you've seen the Israeli models.
Yeah.
And he says, but the thing is, you just tell them they need to get circumcised.
Yeah.
And once they get circumcised, go in there, they'll be weak, and then you massacre all of them.
Yeah.
And then kill their women and children.
Well, you know, where the circumcision started, well, obviously started with Abraham, but as Joshua is to slaughter, you know, Jericho and so forth, you know, he's got his army of 50,000 men. And Ezra about to go into battle, he says, all right, there's one more thing, boys. Before we do it, we've got to chop off the tips of our dicks to please God. I mean, can you imagine the God up the back, you know, when Joshua says, like, is there any questions? You know, I bet there is one. So, but that's the Old Testament. And as capricious and heinous and vindictive as the Old Testament God is, yes, Jesus was a Marxist who promoted peace and wanted to look after the poor and those sort of things. But Jesus, what the trap that liberal Christians get themselves into in defending the New Testament, the Old Testament, is the fact that they'll say, oh, well, when Jesus came along, he got rid of all of that.
Right.
You know, the Old Testament's done, the New Testament came along, it's Jesus, and all you got to do is believe in Jesus and you'll make your way into heaven. But if you read clearly, Jesus says it on no less than umpteen occasions that I have not come here to change one iota of the law being Mosaic law, basically the laws, the 613 commandments stated in the first five books of the Bible. So he was there to defend the law. As you said, he loved being a Jew. He loved being a Jewish more than Woody Allen loved being a Jew.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I was going to get to. Because then the second thing to me that's clear is that people who say, oh, well, the Old Testament doesn't apply anymore, so you guys spare me your whole Leviticus stuff.
Yeah.
But then I say, great, then spare me your Leviticus where you say a man shall not lie with a man, right?
Yeah.
So that's out, right? They say, no, that's still in.
Yeah.
And then I say, okay, great, then we can get rid of Adam and Eve. That was silly. That was just a fairy tale, right? That's in the Old Testament. They say, no, that one stays.
Yeah.
So obviously they're hypocrites about that. They say it stays. They say it goes, depending on what's convenient, right?
Yeah. Cafeteria Christianity, that's what it is.
Exactly. But what I'm unclear about is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the passages where he's a Marxist, mm-hmm. but then there's the passages where he says, bring me a sword because I don't come in peace, I come with a sword.
Yep.
So which one is it?
Well, and that's a problem. When you read the New Testament, and my book, Jesus Lied, He Was Only Human, I actually show how the wild, irreconcilable contradictions there are in the New Testament. So what you have to remember is there are no eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life. Even though we have eyewitness testimonies from people that lived or contemporaries that lived in his time, you know, like Cicero and so forth, Caesar. But of Jesus, there's nothing. No eyewitness testimony, no self-written manuscript, no ditty or poem on why maybe killing a daughter for not observing the Sabbath is probably not a good idea. Nothing. We have nothing of this guy. So the only things we have written of Jesus is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the letters of Paul. But Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John never met Jesus. None of these guys met Jesus. Paul didn't meet Jesus. The first gospel to be written about the life of Jesus was Mark, and he wrote his somewhere between 50 and 70 years after Jesus' supposed execution. 50 to 70 years.
50 to 70 years.
50 to 70 years. Now, so he's taken campfire stories, you know, passed down through the oral tradition, his ministry, his execution, his trial, and so forth. But then Matthew and Luke came along, and Matthew, another 20 years later, and Luke came along 20 years later, and they went, okay, let's take Mark's gospel. Matthew's like, I'm going to try and write a gospel which is going to preach to a Jewish audience. So everything that Mark writes about Jesus is spun in a way that will appeal to the Jewish audience. So everything that Matthew writes is to try and fulfill Jesus' life to prophecy, you know, and to put him in the lineage of David and, you know, Goliath and, you know, David and Solomon and all the kings that came before him. But Luke was trying to appeal to a Gentile audience, and as was Paul, the letters of Paul. So that's when Paul comes along. He's trying to spread this very Jewish religion for Jews to a non-Jewish audience, and that's when he gets rid of the, you know, you can eat bacon, you don't have to circumcise yourself anymore, and that sort of thing. So we don't even really know what Jesus stood for because there's no eyewitness accounts, and the testimonies about his life contradict wildly. I mean, Mark doesn't even mention Mark and John don't even mention the virgin birth. Now, if you're a historian and you leave out the virgin birth, that's like saying, you know, a historian looking back on 9/11 and not mentioning anything about planes being involved, you know.
Yeah,
you know.
So that's super interesting too. I want to talk about Jesus and bacon. First on the historical Jesus, I saw a movie that convinced me that he never existed. Okay,
right.
And so here's what I mean by that. Not that a guy kind of called Jesus, kind of from Nazareth, didn't at some point exist, right? But that it doesn't really matter whether he existed or not, since there's no real eyewitness testimony about it, and things are written. I mean, in an age where things aren't even written down, 50 to 70 years later, I mean, things, when they're written down now and on the internet 50 to 70 years later, they become the exact opposite, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let alone back then.
Yeah.
So even if he existed, the things attributed to him are not what he did. Yeah. They are things that people wanted to attribute to him. Yeah. Okay, it could have been that it was Jesus. It could have been that it was Bob. It could have been that it was nobody. Yeah. It was like just these stories that they wanted to tell, and they picked a name out of a hat. That guy from Nazareth, I don't know, Jesus, let's take him, right? Yeah. He's the one that did all these wonderful things, right? So you think that's right? Do you
That's exactly right. I mean, these were, you know, revisions of history, you know, and that's why if you take, take one event in Jesus' life, after he's crucified. After he's crucified, you know, they go to the tomb. You know, one of the gospels says there was two angels waiting in the tomb. Another gospel says there was one dude there. Another gospel says it was two women. And another gospel said there was nobody there. So, you know, these simple events of Jesus' life don't even match up at all. And so we come back to your point, your earlier point where you said, but Jesus, did he promote peace or did he say to come and bring a sword? Well, who knows what he said, because these stories, wildly contradict each other.
Yeah. So is the sword for the audience that was predominantly Jewish because they wanted to connect back to the Old Testament, which was tougher? Is that the case?
Exactly. They want to show that he was a tough zealot and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right. Oh, good for them.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to Bacon for a second. Yeah. So Paul, it appears to me, is really the genius behind the Bible.
Christianity should be called Paulanity.
Right?
Yeah, the Christian faith is based on everything that Paul said, you know, when he never met Jesus. He met his ghost, apparently, on the road to Damascus.
Did. Oh, okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
At least he got the ghost. Okay. That's logical.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah, today I was doing on the show, I was doing a story about the Yazidis, which is a very horrible and tragic story, but they believe in a peacock angel. Right.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing what people believe?
But the
Christians would call them crazy peacock angels. What are you talking about, right?
Yeah.
Whereas when you challenge them, they say, no, obviously Paul met Jesus' ghost in Damascus. That's why he knows all about. Paul met Jesus' ghost on the road to Damascus. That's why he knows all about Jesus.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. So Paul then takes it to a broader audience and says, it's all right, Jesus loves you all.
Well, but he also took it to a broader audience. So he's taking then the religion to Rome and, you know, all through that Middle Eastern area, not Middle East, through the Mediterranean area, you know, to Greece and Mesopotamia and so forth. And particularly when he gets to Rome, he's like, guys, we've got this great religion. All you'll do is believe in Jesus and you get to heaven. And people are like, okay, I'm listening. You know, you're promising eternal life. That's, who doesn't want that? And but they're like, yeah, but you've got to cut the end of your penis off, count me out. And Paul's like, maybe we need to get rid of that clause. And these guys love eating bacon.
So
we'll get rid of that out. And that's why, you know, Christianity was had broader appeal to the masses. And why Christianity is so popular in a country like America, because it's a religion that requires no effort. There's no religious observances that you really have to take part in. Whereas Islam, it takes a lot of effort to be a Muslim. You've got to go to Mecca. You've got to starve yourself for a month. That's a commitment.
We'll get to Islam in a second. Yeah. Okay. I love the idea of Paul getting to Italy, and they're like, "Well, we like the pepperoni on the pizza." He's like, "Okay, I allow the pepperoni." Okay. Yeah. But Paul was the greatest marketing genius of all time, right? I mean, you're right. So he says, "Okay, don't worry, you're all going to get into heaven. All you got to say is the magic words: I believe in Jesus, and we're done." Yeah. Okay. And God loves you all. But on top of that, if you're poor now, which they all were, right? Yeah. It's going to be great up there, right? Just don't sweat it. So, that's genius. Yeah. Then everybody's going to sign it, right? Yeah. And that's why Christianity spread, right?
Yeah. That's why Joel Osteen turns in $600,000 a month. You know, that's a good promise.
Yeah.
It's a great product.
That snake oil has been selling for a lot of years.
Never gets old. There's no money in atheism.
Me and you both, brother. I hear you on that. Okay. So now let's turn to Islam. So did you read the Quran?
Yeah. I wrote a book on the Quran.
Oh, you wrote a book on the Quran well. Quran Curious?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was going to be Dubai Curious, but it sounded a bit weird.
That's funny, though. I like that. So obviously, they got it right.
Well, the interesting, and I'll say this up front as I told you off air, Quran Curious wasn't my bestseller by any means. Mm-hmm. And I took it from a different angle because in the Quran Curious, I basically wanted to show the anti-Islamic forces in America, like the Israeli lobby to begin with, the military-industrial complex, and the hard right-wing conservatism, which funds the eternal fear of Islam. Because, you know, the military-industrial complex had the fear of the Red Scare, and they had a great run on that. And then, like, well, what do we replace it with? You know, that's done. The cold Berlin Wall's down. Right. So it's been replaced. You know, it's been replaced with Islamic extremism. And I basically want to show that the Quran is as misinterpreted and is cherry-picked by, you know, someone like Michelle Bachmann, who wants to, you know, take a pay, or Sam Harris even, or Richard Dawkins, as much as it's cherry-picked by someone like Osama bin Laden, or, you know, and oh, so well, forth.
That's actually a controversial position. Well, yeah. Fascinating. Okay, yeah, yeah. So let's talk about that. Why do you think Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris cherry-picks it?
Well, because they have an ideological axe to grind, which is that all religion poisons everything, subtitled Christopher Hitchens' book. And so they want to say that, you know, the liberal secular world has advanced to such a degree that we're the enlightened and they're monsters. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just cheap demagoguery what Dawkins mm-hmm. and Harris have engaged in when it comes to Islam. Look, I've lived in the Muslim world for 10 years. I've spent time in the Middle East. Muslims don't want to destroy America. They don't want to take away our freedoms. They don't give a shit that we watch porn. They don't give a shit that we like titty contests or drink beer. Uh-huh. You know, they
secretly kind of like that. But yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I don't know. I might be biased because I'm from Turkey. They love beer and titty porn.
So. Yeah, well, Turkey's, I mean, you know, conservative, almost liberal democracy until this Erdogan. Right. I mean, he's a nut. But
yes,
but,
agreed.
yeah, I mean, you know, their gripes with the West are very specific, and it's get your bases out of the Holy Land and force Israel into a two-state solution. Beyond that, it's nothing. I mean, if the well or the cesspool of terrorism would dry up tomorrow if we got our air bases away from Mecca and we forced a two-state solution. That ends so there and ends there.
On a political level, there's no question you're right. And then, you know, also just footnote, stop invading us. Right. Yeah. So if you could do that, we'd be great. Yeah. And so I know that that's what they think.
Yeah. But also remember, these countries are on the way to liberal democracies in the 60s and 70s. Beirut, Syria, Lebanon. You know, Beirut in, obviously in Lebanon, but Iran even. You know, Beirut was called the Paris of the East. I mean, these are places you could drink beer. Morocco was a place you could have orgies. You know, drink as much booze and smoke as much dope as the best hash in the world. But it was the death of liberalism in these countries, which and was replaced by the eternal war state, which has turned these places into shitstorms. Americans do get that.
They conservatives hate it when we say that. Yeah. But I don't say it because I hate America. I love America. I immigrated to America because I believe in America. Yeah. I'm one of the few, you know, zealots, the real believers, in the dream and the hope and the opportunity and all that. But when we deposed the democratically elected leader of Iran in the 1950s, we poisoned that well. And that poison came back at us, right? And so, and then we push perpetual war, whether it's Iraq or it's Israel.
Mubarak,
and we've all seen it. And it's hurt the secular Muslims more than anyone else. Salman Rushdie talks about it. He said when he was growing up in India as a Muslim, there was none of this fundamentalism, right? Yeah. They were headed towards modernity and things were going to be great. Yeah. When I was growing up in Turkey was, it seemed 100% secular. Yeah. Now all of a sudden you've got fundamentalists running the country and religion is back on the rise. Yeah. They're so frustrated by the Palestinian situation. And I think people outside of that context can't see it straight. That, like, they think, what's the big deal? Why don't the other Arab countries take... No. They feel like every Muslim in the world has been slapped across the face, and there's nothing they could do about it. Yeah. And so in their frustration, they turn to something that isn't true. Yeah. Okay, they turned to the good old days, which weren't... Actually, the great irony of that is that when the Muslims were at the top of the world, had the largest empire, they were 1,000 times more modern than the Muslims today, right? They were the leaders in science. They had the great in mathematics. They were had the biggest libraries in the world, etc. Yeah. So the golden days of Islam was when it was more liberal. Okay, but they misunderstand that, and they in their desperation go towards that. But when it comes to the religion itself, it's equally wrong.
Yeah, absolutely equally wrong. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But you know, the reason why the Middle East and these fundamentalists religious movements have taken hold is because we helped propel the death of liberalism in these countries. We helped kill these liberal democracies. And when you kill liberal democracies, you leave a vacuum that can only be filled by proto-fascist religious movements. That's what's happening here in America today. The reason the Christian right is on the verge of either a takeover or a makeover of America's secular democracy is because liberalism is dead in America. Liberalism died with the election of Reagan in 1980, and then Clinton buried its body when Clinton, you know, embraced deregulation of Wall Street, embraced free trade, NAFTA, destroyed the unions, gutted welfare. So we've basically had three decades of non-stop conservatism in this country, which has destroyed the middle class and the working class. And when you destroy the middle class and the working class, which is what happened in these countries in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s in the Middle East, you now give rise to the emergence of far-right ideologies like the Christian right. And we stand at a very on the precipice of a fascist uprising in this country because the middle class is shrinking at an alarming rate. Income inequalities are off the chart. We're the most un-income equal country amongst OECD nations. So when the Democratic Party embraces the sanctity of the free market like Republicans have, well, what's to separate the two parties on economic issues? And when you take economic issues off the table, all that's left is the culture wars, gods, guns and gays. So the white middle class with no prospects, facing bankruptcy and foreclosure, debt and no prospect for the future, they cling to God, guns and religion. And that's why, you know, these proto-fascist movements take place. And we're seeing an alarming rise of far-right ideological violence in this country right now.
I hear you on all that, but don't worry. We're going to rise up before they do. Okay? So don't you worry about it.
Yeah, well, you're more optimistic than me.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but let's talk about the last book here, Atheists Can't Be Republicans. Mm-hmm. Now, S.C. Cupp would claim otherwise.
And Karl Rove.
You're right.
Yeah.
Well, Karl Rove doesn't claim to be an atheist.
Oh, I think he has, hasn't he?
Well, he said it, but he tries to bury it now. I mean, yeah. He certainly doesn't come out on Fox News and be like, here, over here, I'm an atheist, yeah. Right?
No.
So, but he clearly is. But,
yeah.
But that's... So, so what's your sense of it? Well, why can't they be Republicans?
Well, we like smart people. Number one. But number two, you know... The reason you're an atheist is because you see no evidence for the existence of a deity or a god. Now, if you apply that same litmus test or logic to your political ideology, then organized religion is false and dangerous in every which way that conservatism is false and dangerous. Every policy of the Republican Party in the last three decades has been proven abjectly false. They said the stimulus, the economy was driven off the cliff through Wall Street capitalism or casino capitalism. We're losing 800,000 jobs per month when Obama came into office. Every economist, impartial economist, says you need stimulus. Keynesian economics to get the economy started. The Republicans said no, it'll cause inflation. Big spending liberals, here they go again. It'll only exacerbate the economy into a downward spiral. Stimulus created added 2 to 3 points of GDP growth, created 6 million job years to the economy, has been a success by every metric, and it could have been doubly successful if the Republicans had have allowed the stimulus to have been double of what it was. That's one policy. Bush, trickle-down economics. They continue to prescribe trickle-down economics when, again, every nonpartisan economist in the world has described it as an abject failure. And the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts are the biggest tax cuts for the rich since Reagan in 1980. His cuts in 81, 82. We had the worst job growth in this country since World War II. And that's not even taken into consideration the GFC or the Great Recession crash of 07, 08. Then you go into climate change, then you go into the separation of church and state, then you go into evolution. On any policy you pick, they've been proven wrong.
So that's interesting. I come at it from the other side of it, but agree in the sense that I think that the right wing chose religious people to target because they thought, well, these people, we can get them to believe unbelievable things, mm-hmm. right? So they don't work in the logic-based world. They work in the faith-based world.
Yep.
So we can just tell them, as I remember, I'll never forget, in 2004, I read an Associated Press article. They interviewed this woman, and they asked her about all these Bush policies right before the election. She doesn't like any of them, but she doesn't know it. She says she loves Bush, but she's against everything he's done when asked individually. And then they say, so why are you voting for Bush?
I'd like to have a beer with him.
No. He's with God.
Oh my God!
But how do you know that? They just told you that, right?
Yeah.
But there's no facts to back up that Bush is with God. Yeah. She doesn't need facts. She just needs an authority figure to say that, right? So if you're looking for suckers, fundamentalists would be a pretty good pool to fish in, right?
Yeah, and I mean they're the unwitting pawns, you know, for corporate overlords. That's what they are. And Thomas Frank, I think, you know, has written, you know, his book. What's the Matter with Kansas is one of the best political tomes that you'll read on the subject of how conservatives took the predominantly working class red states through the heartland. And, the trick is always the same, and the Christian right continually to get duped with the same tricks. They vote for abortion, they receive, you know, privatization of Social Security in return. They vote for to prevent gay marriage. They receive, you know, deunionization. vote for a strong stance on terror, and they, you know, elect to make the powerful even more powerful. You know,
and of course they're always going to lose on gay rights. I've been saying this on the show for many years, and the reason for that is we have more money. That's the one issue of progressives have more money than conservatives on. Yeah. So we are guaranteed victory.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened in New York. They got, you know, gay marriage passed because four Republicans took several hundred thousand dollars in bribes from hedge fund managers who are Republicans and want lower taxes, but also happen to either be gay or a family member who's gay.
Yeah.
So that's the way it works.
Yeah.
So they're never going to get win on that. They're suckers. Yeah. Instead, they're going to cut their own wages and then wonder what happened, but then keep voting with the Republicans because God told them to, even though they never actually talked to God.
Yeah,
exactly. Right?
Exactly.
Slash God doesn't exist, but that's a whole different thing. Okay, anyway. Yeah. So now let's talk about the last part of it, which is, what's the best approach? Because when I say things like God doesn't exist, and maybe Jesus as a historical figure didn't actually exist, heads explode, they boom, blinders come on, earmuffs, don't want to listen to you, you're crazy. They find out, like, they find it laughable. Like, oh, Jesus didn't exist, this guy's a lunatic, like he didn't walk on water and the virgin, idiot, right?
Yeah.
So what's the best approach to get people on our side? What's your take on that?
Well, I don't think we have the fight too hard. I think it's happening anyway. If you look at millennials, old white people that cling to gods, guns, and religion, they're on the way out. They can't live forever unless they eat an abundance of acai and green tea. But they're dead. So the millennial, you look at the millennials, 75% of millennials are for same-sex marriage. Millennials are shunning organized religion, whether that's because of the scandals of the Catholic Church, whether that's because of the overzealousness of the Republican Party or the Christian right. The fastest two growing religions, if you include atheism and religion, which is clearly not, you know, atheists are the fastest growing minority in this country. Second to that is the religious affiliation nuns, the ones who call them nuns, spiritual but not religious. It's happening on its own. And so what we're seeing is the final death throes of a white victimization minority politics, which is clinging onto the last vestige of the culture they once believed in, they see evaporating before their fingers. So we're going to win this battle, like we've won the battle on same-sex marriage, like we've won the battle on civil rights acts. Progressiveness, always wins in the end,
So I'm going to write a whole book about that. But so Washington pundits crack me up. Like, oh, it's a center-right country.
Yeah.
Except conservatives are the Washington Generals of America, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, in the short term, yes, they win a lot more than the Washington Generals do, right? Mm-hmm. But in the long term, they never win. We freed the slaves. The conservatives didn't want that. First of all, the conservatives didn't even want the revolution. They wanted to stay with the monarchy, right?
Yeah, right.
We got civil rights. We got women's rights. We got gay rights. They always lose. Yeah. Ironically, they're like Satan.
Yeah.
Their whole point of having them in the plot line is just so they can lose.
Yeah. They never win. But that only serves to make him more vitriolic, but also more dangerous. And that's why the rise, and I come back to this earlier point, the rise of right-wing violence is staggering in this country. You look at those two shooters, that husband and wife team that shot those two cops in Las Vegas and they shot the Walmart employee. Now, if you read their manifesto, that reads, two white people that listen to nothing but Fox News who are becoming totally disillusioned with the political solution because they see Hispanics pouring across the border. They see a black guy in the White House who thinks they believe is coming for their guns and their religion. And, you know, you and I hear rhetoric like that and we just dismiss it as hyper-partisan, you know, hyperbolic rhetoric. Somebody who's unhinged and living, you know, and as a member of a right-wing militia somewhere in the deep south, they think, righto, time to lock and load. I'm going to go to Clive Bundy's ranch. I'm going to point a rifle at a Bureau of Land Management officer, or I'm going to kill two cops. You're now far more likely to be killed by a right-wing American in this country than you are by a Muslim American citizen in this country. Since 1990 to 2010, 345 Americans were killed by right-wing extremist violence. Only 20 were killed by Muslim Americans.
I mean, we talked about how it's a dangerous combination to have Republican right-wing politicians joined up with God, because then you get people to shut off logic and just go in a direction and then wind up doing themselves economic damage. But, you know, we also talked about God, guns, and gays. The first two parts of that are also incredibly dangerous. When you have people who have stopped thinking logically and have eschewed the reason-based world, and then you give them weaponry, that's pretty scary. So I see it as, and this is interesting, that progressives are going to win. That's why I'm hopeful, because we've always won, right? Mm-hmm. But we're in a race against time, right? Before they close off all the windows and we go towards the fascist state that you're talking about, right? Yeah. Because they got the guns, they're mad, they've got all the money, the corporate donors, et cetera, and they've fixed the system now. The guy with more money wins 95% of the time, so we're screwed on that. And then the last thing is the internet. They hate the internet because, one, it's not pro-establishment, and number two, people find out things in the internet. Yeah. You know, I love the story that we did once. This Mormon leader trying to convert people to Mormonism, people would keep telling him things about his own religion he didn't even know. And then he's like, where'd you see that? And he'd be like, they're like the internet. So he went on the internet and he said, oh my God, you're right. It turns out we're supposed to believe this. Oh, this is crazy.
Yeah,
and he stopped being a Mormon. Yeah. Right?
Well, it wasn't Mitt Romney, was it?
Yeah, no. If they close off the internet, well then the conservatives might win for the first time, and if they do, like in a big way, and if they do, then we're all in a world of trouble.
Even though demographics are running counter to conservative politics, and certainly to the Republican Party, whether it's on immigration, gay rights, any number of social issues, the danger is the Republican Party has a very simple, effective strategy, and that is to totally destroy America's faith in government. And when your whole platform is built on, government isn't part of the solution, government is the problem, and when you make government totally dysfunctional, where, you know, people don't have time to drill down to the issues. They turn on CNN for 5 minutes and, you know, there's Republicans and Democrats fighting again. Why can't they get along is what Americans will say. No, there is one party who's actively engaged as a strategy to nullify, to obstruct any policy so that we lose faith so much in Washington that when your position is that government sucks, well, who stands to benefit when Americans believe government sucks? Well, the party that's been saying all along that government sucks. So if we go to a low turnout election, which is the whole Republican battle plan, make Americans so disillusioned with the electoral system, have a massively low turnout, they have every chance of winning, which is how Bush beat Gore in 2000.
Right. One, because they have more money, and two, because they have convinced that 25% of the country that is evangelical, Christian fundamentalist, to always vote with Republicans, because Republicans are with God. Right or wrong, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Turn off your reason and vote Republican. And it unfortunately happens in a lot of countries. That's what happened in Turkey, which is all the other politicians are corrupt and, you know, the whole, it's a mess, etc. And they can't keep any coalition together, but the religious coalition, the one that keeps winning, never breaks because they never question.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they all say, oh, what do my leaders say? I'm supposed to vote for Erdogan? I vote for Erdogan. Yeah. They vote for him every time, and he's the only one that can collect enough votes in a parliamentary system to win.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm always scared of parliamentary systems, because you can always find 25% of a country that's religious fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And then they can take over. But here they've managed to do it anyway, you know, without a parliamentary system.
Yeah.
Okay, well, fear not, everybody. We're going to fight back. Okay, we're going to fight back through the Young Turks, through CJ's books, which you should read, and through Wolfpack, of course, wolf-pack.com. We're going to regain our democracy. But latest book is Atheists Can't Be Republicans If Facts and Evidence Matter. Check it out. CJ, thanks so much for being on.
Thanks,
we appreciate it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.